General's Office of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and I will be your moderator today. The topic, as you know, is very much at the fore of announcements that have been made from various tech companies. And of course, here in Davos, every day there are sessions on nuclear or there are sessions on AI and data centers. So we're pleased to be hosting you for this conversation today. And our speakers are regulars also at Davos. I'm sure you're very familiar with all of them. Some of you have been in sessions with them already today, but I will introduce you very briefly to them. Rafael Mariano Grossi is the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Zachary Bogue is the founder and managing partner of DCVC, and Rachel Morrison is the energy and environment editor at Bloomberg News in London. They will share their perspectives and expertise on some of the recent developments, particularly on tech companies shifting to nuclear to meet their energy demand. We'll do a couple of rounds with the speakers, and then I hope to open the floor to questions from the floor. DG Grossi, traditionally nuclear has been very much state-led. Usually countries announce large infrastructure projects, and now we're seeing more of a shift towards a demand-driven approach from industry. We're seeing a more dynamic situation with the possibility of small modular reactors which can be used for specific purposes. And over the past year, regularly we've seen announcements, as I mentioned earlier, from Google, from Meta, Microsoft, Oracle, and others, to turn to nuclear energy to meet that demand. Is this a trend of the moment and will disappear when the next new thing comes along? How do you see those developments and announcements this past year?
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for being here or logging for a streaming session. As you said, we are living a very exciting phase in terms of the contribution of nuclear energy, nuclear technologies in the current energy circumstance, which may include aspects related to climate change or others specifically, very directly related to the needs, the huge needs for electricity that we are seeing all over the world, and a return to what I call a return to realism in recognizing that nuclear energy has an indispensable contribution to make. And this you can decline into different things. Of course, the traditional nuclear production reactors, which are the core of the nuclear contribution to the global electricity production, which is going to continue, very important to be said, and is going to continue in big way as we see new build in many countries all over the world. The modularity, the small modularity factor which appears now is not just a fad, it is something one has to recognize that has been mentioned and discussed for many, many years. I started in nuclear in 1984, and already then in the mid 1980s, there was discussion about small reactors or modular reactors, etc. The big difference now is that this is a reality now. And we've moved from the PowerPoint or maybe slides in the past or whatever to things that are being constructed, things that are being planned, contracts that are being signed, as you say, and as a first, the demand-driven factor, which is so important, because now we have an industry there, we have a world out there that is looking, not necessarily at nuclear, is looking at whatever is needed to power the activities, to power the functions that are needed for today's economy to be sustained. And of course, nuclear with its sustainability, dispatchability, reliability, as proven by more than 60 years of commercial operation, is and has appeared as something indispensable. But what I like about your quip on the thing that may be replaced is that the small modularity talks about the innovation that comes with nuclear. There is some idea out there that nuclear is an old technology. Nuclear has been evolving, is evolving constantly, and the modularity is one of these aspects. Modularity that is going to be important in terms of pure energy production, but in many different forms. Today, with our friends, we are focusing on AI. But I see the naval shipping industry looking at small modular reactors. I see steel industry. I see countries looking at it for desalination needs. So there is a panoply, I would say, of areas of interest, private and public as well. Because even if SMR seems to be attracting for the most the interest of industry, the private sector also, hardly a week passes without me getting a call from a minister of energy of a country, especially countries which that until now were not contemplating perhaps a big build, because of grid reasons, because of local capacities, supply chain factors, and now because of this new business model, which is not a replacement model, which is an additional model to nuclear, is offering.
Thank you, Director General. Let me turn to you, Zachary. As a long-term investor in clean tech, what changes have you seen from when you started to now?
Sure. So as a deep tech venture catalyst, it means we invest in things like hard problems in the climate, including fission and fusion, as well as AI. And it's actually terrific to see the power demand from AI putting nuclear fission back on the table, which is a huge positive for humanity. And the trends I'm seeing is, you know, I've been an investor, I haven't been working on this as long as the Director General, but I've been investing venture capital dollars in nuclear fission since 2014. And huge difference. This is a 180 degree difference from back then. Back then it was sort of viewed as a fringe and not really, you know, mainstream. But even a year ago, here at the WEF, I think they had their first ever session on nuclear power. It was the first time ever. It was a lunch.
Yes.
And they felt it was a bold step. And then, well, what a difference a year makes. So fast forward till now, and it's obviously a lot driven by sort of in the U.S., we sort of have the first increase in power or in electricity demand sort of since sort of the 90s. And this sort of generational increase in demand is partly driven by the voracious demand for data centers. There's also electric vehicles and other, you know, electrification of everything and, you know, population growth, but a lot of, and sort of reshoring of manufacturing, but a lot of it is driven by this voracious demand for data centers. You know, several of my fission companies already have huge backlogs. This is pre-approval, so like 14 gigawatts of backlog, of actual hard binding orders, just shows you the demand for these data centers. And that's, you know, and a lot of people don't realize this. We hear a lot about the hyperscalers, and they're talking about 500 megawatts, gigawatt scale data centers. And those are what's planned. And the biggest that we've heard of internally at DCVC is about 800 megawatts. So I don't even think that there's a gigawatt really like on a, you know, legitimate timeline. But people don't realize that the average data center is 15 megawatts, which is actually right inside the envelope for SMRs. SMRs are about 10 megawatts to 300 megawatts. So that actually fits pretty well inside the envelope of what an SMR can deliver. Sort of 15 and, you know, or up to 100. But so that actually, and they're obviously modular, so you can stack them up. So that is sort of the trend on that. And I just to, you know, further embodiment of the voracious demand for the electricity is actually even our micro reactor. So a micro reactor is sub 10 megawatts. We have a micro reactor company that's operating at a megawatt scale. So 1 megawatt, they're actually getting uptake from, and they're also pre-approval, they're also getting uptake from data centers, where even sort of some of these smaller data centers, they just can't get power anywhere. So they're actually starting to look to even these micro reactors that lets them get incrementally more power and also can act as sort of a redundancy or a backup power. So, you know, the trends are many, but right now, you know, it's sort of full steam ahead, so to speak, on demand for SMRs driven by the data center and the AI boom.
Thank you, Zachary. And Rachel, you have been covering energy issues for a very long time too. And so far we've seen this demand coming particularly from tech companies in the United States. What's your outlook on other regions where in Europe, in Asia, in Latin America, in Africa? What are you seeing in terms of this kind of demand from tech companies?
Yeah, I would really say at the moment there's a split between the US and Europe, and the situation that Zachary describes, you know, we see the share prices of utilities in the US being driven by AI demand, but that's not happening in Europe at such a pace. There's lots of hopes and dreams for data centers at the moment in Europe, but they aren't already driving demand. And demand isn't growing that quickly in Europe, especially if you take somewhere like the UK, demand's quite flat. So a lot of companies are waiting and anticipating that increase in demand. You know, we do have the target set for electrification. It has to happen in order to meet those targets, but it is quite slow to kind of kick off. There are ambitions in lots of places to be data center hubs. We have the UK wants to have areas which will have data centers, and there is a problem with adding a huge chunk of demand onto a system that is uninterruptible. You need a constant supply of electricity all the time, and you don't want to turn up and down your ops, which we do have a problem to fix on the demand side of varying demand to meet renewable supply. So I think those two things, there's quite an interesting inflection point where you're adding a lot of inflexible demand, and then you do need a sort of chunk of baseload capacity to help with that, because renewables, it, you know, it can be tricky without some kind of backup.
Thanks, Rachel. We'll do a next round of questions, and then I will open up the floor. DG, the IEA is hosting its first AI conference later this year. So can you tell us a bit more what the IEA is doing particularly in this area? And can you tell me a little bit, can you tell us a little bit more about the conference?
Well, the IEA is not just a forum for discussion. Having discussions is fantastic, but like here, and it's necessary, and we have to inform and have a public opinion that is aware. The IEA has a normative function. It has inspection, nuclear safety, nuclear non-proliferation functions that are very specific and that are real, not only enablers, but allowers of things like this to happen. Often I get questions from journalists. Some of them, they say, well, all this modularity that is there, is it going to be a good thing? Can we be reassured that now that many countries all over the world may have access to a nuclear reactor, perhaps in smaller economies or countries that do not enjoy the institutional density that you need, a regulator, in plain English, to be sure what is happening. So for us, it is very important because we are the ones to guarantee that these hopefully thousands of nuclear reactors, small and micro reactors that are going to be out there, are going to be subject to inspections, are going to be subject to safety and security standards. And also, not only from the, I would say, monitoring side, also many countries are going to have the capacity building that is necessary. We do a lot of that. We train the workforce in many countries so that more and more can benefit from that. When we talk about Europe or North America, it's obvious, or China, India, and a few countries in the global south, as it is called now. But what we are seeing here is something that could have real global reach. And this is why the IEA has not only the obligation, but also the responsibility to be in the lead for this kind of effort that we are having. And this is why we're so excited that we are going to have a first international conference. That the critical mass, to use a nuclear term, the critical mass is finally there for us to have an international conference where people like you, Zach, and the analysts and journalists will be there, but member states, we have 180 countries that are part of the IEA and are going to be there, and there is a huge interest in that. So hopefully we'll be seeing you all when this conference takes place.
Thank you, Director General. And Zachary, going back to some of the points you raised earlier, we talked a lot about, you mentioned some of the work that is happening and it's intensifying to get things running. And investors are spending a lot of money into new private nuclear companies. And this has increased rapidly over the years. Now, can this pace of financing match the energy demand from the tech companies when these will eventually be on the ground?
Sure. Yeah, I'll sort of zoom out and talk about the financing piece in general. And one of the reasons why we're talking about SMRs today, as well as micro reactors, is because those are, by definition, much smaller reactors, which are more, you can think of these as proof of concept. And it's much easier to build just a smaller reactor on venture capital dollars, right? So if we could be building gigawatt scale plants, we would, that'd be terrific. But the SMRs actually, you know, are a much more capital efficient way to sort of get your model approved by the regulator, demonstrate it works, it's safety, and then they actually can scale up in size once you've sort of established that proof of concept. So one, the financing piece, the SMRs and micro reactors work really well with venture capital dollars, which are some of the most expensive money you can take as a startup. And it's sort of enabling these new models to be explored. And then, you know, in terms of the financing, you know, it's, you know, my, you know, I'm an investor in one of the leading sort of generation four reactor companies called Oklo, and Oklo is now publicly traded on the NYSE. And obviously being a member of the public markets, you know, gives you access to the cheapest cost of equity capital and the cheapest cost of debt capital. So that's sort of, you know, one pathway. But in sort of climate tech investing, there's, you know, what's known as sort of the missing middle, which is kind of at the Series B, but there's sort of a series of these. There's sort of the missing middle, or they also call it sort of more prosaically the valley of death for these climate companies. And as of right now, there's a lot of innovation coming around, you know, types of non-dilutive or project finance that can come in and fill that. So these models will need to come online in order to scale the reactors, the SMRs, in order to keep pace with the demand from the hyperscalers. There's obviously always going to be room for the big existing fleet, which we're starting to turn a lot of those back on, and it's that can also make up for a lot of the demand. The other interesting thing is that in terms of the financing and how to keep up with the pace is that, you know, SMR companies and microreactors, they don't talk about sort of at scale building a series of reactors around the country or the world. They actually talk about building factories to build reactors. And that's sort of the thinking behind SMRs, where you can just build these things in a factory and sort of stamp them out, which is a much, you know, much more standardized way of building and much more, you know, rapid and sort of financeable. So that's another way that, you know, is a pathway forward to keeping up with this voracious demand. I'm hoping that sort of all of the funding and SMR development can really accelerate, because obviously if we don't match demand, you know, that gap will likely just be made up with natural gas, and then those plants have, you know, 30-year life at least of operation. So, you know, it really is an imperative to sort of accelerate the capital and the development and the, you know, all of the pieces of this to meet that demand.
Thanks, Zachary. And of course, building things involves people. So let me turn back to you, Rachel. I know you've written also extensively on this issue. Is there enough of a skilled workforce to be able to meet that demand that will be needed? And where do you see the gaps there as well?
Yeah, I suppose politicians want to deliver jobs and green jobs. And there was a time in the UK when projects would only get approved, you know, they would compete as to how many jobs they would deliver. Data centres don't offer very many jobs. Nuclear, obviously, a lot more. And there is a real competition for those engineers, because there's lots of infrastructure projects happening at the same time as the, you know, the energy transition. So if, and those engineers can be locked into projects for quite a long time. So we are hearing quite interesting things about competition for skilled workers, which does send the message that there needs to be more. But yeah, it takes quite a long time. I think it's a big piece of the picture and something that the nuclear industry can offer. are those skilled jobs which can last for decades, because obviously nuclear takes a long time to build. But then you have companies like EDF that want to move the same people from project to project. So it kind of, the modular aspect of things, whether it's large scale or small scale, depends on being able to access those workers and move them around to different projects, because, you know, the time scales that we're talking about, you can't FID on a project and then find that the second phase, you don't have enough people who can weld. And I've chaired some discussions in the UK, which apparently welders are very much in short supply. So get your kids trained up as welders.
Thanks, Rachel. Right, let me open up to you to join the conversation. Please raise your hand so that I can see where you are, and I will get to you in the order that I see you. Rachel, I know you already asked, Kirsty, I know you already asked to speak, and you had some questions and comments for the DG as well and the other panelists. So I'll give you the floor.
And could folks, if you ask a question, could you say your name and where you're from?
Oh, yes, please identify yourselves and try to keep, in the interest of getting everybody to intervene, please try to keep your questions and comments concise. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kirsty Gogan from Terra Praxis. So this is a hot topic. Clearly, I just want to make three very brief points with questions attached. So firstly, AI for licensing. So we're working with Microsoft to develop a new tool to generate license applications, nuclear license applications with AI, which represents, you know, licensing represents currently a very major barrier to nuclear development. And that tool is now, you know, available, and we expect to see that, you know, transform the potential for example, generating early site permits for fleets of coal plants that could be converted to nuclear. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on, you know, leveraging AI to build more AI infrastructure. And the second point is related to data centers, which, you know, used to be complicated, expensive, and slow to build, which sounds familiar in the nuclear industry. And the data center industry was very successful in radically reducing costs of delivering data centers from around $20 a watt to $2 a watt today through a process of standardization, modularization, open architecture systems. So I'm really interested to know whether you're aware of any efforts by our, you know, colleagues in the nuclear industry to look at the success of cost reduction in delivering data centers and seeing how that could be applied to mass manufactured reactors delivery. And the third point is about digital equity. You know, we're working with global technology companies that are interested in massively expanding their footprint, enabling access to digital technology in places like Africa. But clearly, you know, you have to have power generation that can meet the 99.999% reliability required by data centers. And so these technology companies are interested in nuclear. I'd love to hear the DG's perspective on, you know, how we might really plan to fully expand nuclear energy into these markets that don't currently have mature nuclear regulatory capability, but, you know, can't wait decades either. Thanks.
Thanks, Kirsty. We have a quick few questions, so maybe we'll do a few together and then we'll come back to you.
Or should we just answer? I'm not going to remember much more than
this. All right, DG, would you like to would you like to go first?
Yeah, thank you. Briefly, so we all have time, on the licensing thing, it's very exciting. Thank you for letting us know, and I'm sure that there will be possibilities to socialize that when we have the international IEA conference. I think it's very important that not only the those building and producing small modular reactors are aware of that, I think it's very important that the regulators accept, embrace, and understand why we are doing this. So this is very important. You mentioned standardization. I think we have to recognize that this continues to be a challenge. We are trying to help in this regard. Of course, we are an international organization, and this is up for industry to do. But in terms of code sharing and other important areas where industry has to deliver, I think there's still room for improvement. I don't want to get bureaucratic, but the IEA has some processes there where we are having the industry together with the regulators and the private sector and everybody, but I still see challenges there. Lastly, on the issue of course, the regulatory capabilities and the lacks thereof, especially in countries that do not have that, and how to see that as, of course, as a prerequisite, because it has to be a prerequisite for anybody to run anything. I'm optimistic. This is one of the things that we are trying to do. Let's look at success stories more than the vision of someone. Let's look at what happened in the UAE, for example, which maybe 20 years ago had zero nuclear experience, zero nuclear capability, zero nuclear regulators. Now, four nuclear reactors, FARC, which is a world-class regulator, 30% of the energy of the Emirates from nuclear. And they have been following the book. We have something which is the milestones approach, which is, you know, like Nuclear for Dummies, where you tell people from day one, from when a politician says, I want my MTV, I want my nuclear reactor, what is it that you need to do? It's a challenge, because much as we lack maybe workforce in nuclear, the IEA is a relatively small organization with a very, very small budget, but with what we have, we train regulators all over the world.
Thank you, Director General. And Zachary.
Yeah, especially on the AI piece. Absolutely. So the beauty of sort of the modular reactors that can be produced in a factory is that, yeah, each one of those applications is going to be practically identical. So terrific use case for AI is also incredibly complicated. And there's good analogies to also FDA submissions. So there's thinking out there that sort of, generative AI can actually reduce just the mere process of preparing an application for the FDA by up to a year, which is pretty crazy. And also means that it catches everything that you miss. Hey, you forgot subpart C. So I think it's a terrific use case for AI. I also will call out that AI is incredibly useful for sort of these new reactor designs as they come on. You can build digital twins and model the reactions much more precisely than was ever possible, which is reassuring to the regulators, reassuring to all of us to have a much better understanding of. And that also applies to fusion as well. So right now we've been reading a lot of updates in the news about all the breakthroughs in the fusion. And these are all different companies, most of which are working on sort of very different technologies to try to achieve fusion. And one of the things that's underpinning all of that, why they're all making breakthroughs at the same time, is the maturity of the computational stack, just the computational ability to do these large scale simulations. And then in terms of the terrific idea of looking to data centers as inspiration, I'll also say that the startups in the space, they're look very broadly for sort of the inspiration. And right now there's also a lot of sort of the diaspora from Tesla and SpaceX that are out there as well. And those are also best in class processes in manufacturing. And there's just sort of this whole boom in manufacturing. So I think there's plenty of areas for sort of the soon to be built SMR factories to sort of draw inspiration from. And
thanks, Zachary.
I'll just defer to you guys on the
I guess I would just add a little bit of realism, perhaps, that in SMRs, it is difficult. EDF recently had to change their design from a more complicated to a less complicated design because it wasn't going to work. And there are examples of failed projects too. So I think it is still, I was talking to someone this morning, sort of saying optimistically, maybe a prototype somewhere in the world, 2027. Maybe operational at best 2030. So, it is exciting, but still a bit far away.
Thanks, Rachel. Right, gentleman down the back, and then Ian Edwards.
Shall I go ahead?
Sure, you've got the microphone.
Okay, thanks. Heike Freund from Marvel Fusion, a fusion energy company based out of Munich. And I'll keep it a very short question. I'm looking at that kind of like chicken and egg problem that we are also seeing when it comes to supply chain development and workforce development, because I think on the one side, as a fusion energy company, I can push my technology forward, and that is kind of, as long as I have enough investments and capital, that's in my hand, right? But I would need the supply chain to also massively start investing into, like, we are a laser-based company, so investing into laser capabilities, diode capabilities, and so on. But they are still looking at this a bit from like, okay, but first we need to see that you prove that your technology works, but if they wait to invest in their supply chain until my technology works, then that whole timeline get shifted out, right? So I'd love to hear your view, and I think workforce development is a very similar topic. Like, how can we push workforce development and supply chain development in parallel so that we really get to a ramp up and deployment of fusion power plants at scale, and not only like starting one in 2035 and the next one in 2040 and so on?
I think it's a real problem, and it's sort of, you know, almost for any new industry. And the best answer we've got is you just sort of muddle through and try and, you know, pull as much through as you can. And the nice thing, I mean, about this AI boom is that it's enabling some companies to sign sort of these binding offtake agreements, you know, power purchase agreements, that can then be used that sort of are inspectable. So then your potential suppliers at least can see that you have sort of a, you know, an offtake if it does come. And that's more for the in the fission space. But it's just.
But in fusion, we have also seen the first customer contract actually with Microsoft.
Yeah, Helion, for sure. So, and that's really helpful.
Those
yeah.
Those are the signs that we need right now.
Yeah. So those are that's sort of the best, you know, the best way we've seen to address that. It's a tough problem. Hopefully, you're not going to the moon for Helium-3 as part of your supply chain. good.
Ian Carton, Standard Bank of South Africa. Some of the questions have been answered, but from an African perspective, DG, are you aware of any countries that are actually advanced in putting the regulatory framework in place? And in Africa?
In Africa.
And Zach, from standing start, financed, yeah. Regulatory framework in place, how long does it take for an SMR to be up and running on a greenfield or brownfield site?
Yeah, briefly, in Africa, of course, all the countries currently involved in nuclear, and involved in nuclear does not mean necessarily like South Africa that has nuclear power generation. Egypt is the next in line, as you know, 4 nuclear power plants being built in Daba. And a set of countries, Ghana, Senegal, Kenya, Rwanda, Uganda, and others that are actively engaged, Tunisia, Morocco, that are actively engaged in conversation with the IEA, interested basically in SMR approaches. All of them, of course, have regulators. And in all of these cases, we engage very early on with them on the specific requirements, regulatory requirements for this kind of operation, yes.
In terms of... Well, from a standing start, you know, 20 years for an overnight success for a deep tech startup. But I think you mean from a standing start from an approved reactor design. And the nice thing is that a lot of stuff can happen to make progress before the reactor design is approved. So, you know, there's already, you know, site approvals and work that can be done on the site, as well as sort of a cold demo that's actually, you know, you build your device and turn it on, but with a heat source rather than radioactive material. So there's a lot of work gets done before that approval process, and also work on sort of the fuel supply chain and supplying the fuel. So once that actually you get that approval, it is kind of on the scale of years to be able to build that first one, and hopefully shorter than that. But obviously you're building a first of a kind facility still, and having to deal with the regulators and, you know, shipping fuel and all of that. So I think that's still on the order of years, but it's sort of tough to dial in.
Thanks, Zachary. Let's take some questions on this side. Oh, sorry, Ian.
Thank you. So Ian Edwards, I'm the CEO of Atkins Rallis. We own the rights to deploy the Canadian technology globally and support it and operate it. So I was thinking about Rachel's inflection point, which often sometimes feels a bit more like a perfect storm at the moment, because 80% of the world's electrons are produced by fossil fuels, and we're losing that battle to actually change that in time for 2050. We've got the introduction of electric vehicles, electric manufacturing, electric heating, and then AI. My question is probably more of a comment. If governments and government utilities are really there to provide social stability to the electrical grid, to make sure the lights are on and that power is there, and economic development through energy can be developed, should the tech companies, who arguably can afford it, I mean, should it be more of an obligation than a choice for them to provide their own power for these next generation data centers and AI data centers? Because arguably, we're not going to get to the right place by 2050, and there's a trade-off here to be had. So maybe a comment from Rachel on that?
Yeah, no, I see where you're coming from, and I think that you're right. It could reach the critical point where if those data centers are taking power off the grid, then does that mean that other people can't get power, or that, you know, demand increases so quickly that the amount of green power can't increase as quickly? And there are things like PPAs, and I think we have seen the first data center that did, I can't remember which one it was, that did co-invest in the generation. And I think that will have to become more common, because otherwise, yeah, we're just going to be spending all of the sites will, you know, for new renewables will go to feed data centers, and all of the cables, all of the connections, all of that. You know, there's competition for everything. Every part of building something, there's a huge amount of competition. Everybody, you know, there's years long grid queues in every country, and there aren't enough people making the wind turbines, making the bits for the grid that you need. So yeah, I think there's just going to be more and more competition for every piece, and that's to your supply chain point as well.
And I think it's already happening, where utilities, you know, the utilities say, fine, we'll give you more power for the data center 15 years from now. So that you really are seeing the big tech companies, the hyperscalers, signing these agreements and taking it onto themselves to find their own power. And then we also had the example, I think it was for a restart of a nuclear plant or a new nuclear plant, where it was all of that power was going to go to Amazon. And then the regulators came in and said, no, this plant sort of belongs to the utility and the people, and like, you can't take all of that power and you need to find your own power. So I definitely agree with that. And I think if they're going to need 500 megawatts for a new data center, they should procure that. And probably that's cheaper for them in the long run than relying on a utility anyway. I also say that we're seeing in communities around the US, not all of them, but a lot of these communities are now pushing back on having data centers there. As you referenced, no jobs or very few jobs from a data center. It's a big building that's kind of noisy, sucks up all of your water and power for a community, and like that's a big problem. So like, there is, you know, the hyperscalers really do need to deal with the externalities of these, whether it's sort of from the power or the water or the power procurement.
If I may add just a bit on that, I think this issue that Ian, you're raising of the state and the demand, and how you combine that, of course, it's an open question how best you get to that. But it's interesting to see that, for example, some countries, I was just 3 weeks ago in Argentina and was discussing with President Milei, and he has just launched a specific effort aimed at having AI and nuclear together through SMRs. And you can see there that they are trying to, I don't know, I mean, the IEA, of course, is going to try to help, as we are helping every country, in trying to articulate that in the best possible way, getting together the regulatory capabilities, the R&D that they have, because they export some reactors into something that, you know, in PPA form or whatever form, goes into that. So I see new configurations that are coming up. So we'll see how successful they are. Well, we all hope they are. I think it has a lot of potential, but we are seeing this new dialogue. And I think your question is very interesting in that sense. There's a new dialogue, a new idea of how to share responsibilities and opportunities for utilities, for the private sector, for the R&D sector, for the big labs, etc.
Thank you. We have time for probably two more questions, and then I will bring you back to the panel for some closing remarks. Gentleman at the front and followed by you. Just here. No.
There's a gentleman there. That, yeah. And you.
I'm Alejandro Guglielmi from Beusa Energy US. And what do you have to say about this nuclear reactors based on thorium? I heard somebody talking about that, and the excuses that they gave because they're not doing them is because the military wants.
Now, if the question is addressed to me,
yes.
Well, you know, there's been thorium as has been considered for decades as a possible. And there are certain countries, for example, India, that have been working on the cycle of thorium for many, many years. So the scientific technological feasibility is proven. There's no problem. Apparently, you know, the extraction and processing of thorium continues to be more expensive than uranium. So this is why there has been much more emphasis on the other. But I don't see any sort of conspirational thing against thorium or the fact that there is some reserved area for military purposes or that. No.
I've also just heard anecdotally, and I don't have the true backup for this, but that thorium on the balance in a reactor, you know, creates more related radioactivity. So it's also just harder to work with. It's not impossible. Sort of these problems have all been solved in the uranium side, but it's just incrementally more radioactivity that you need to deal with. That just, you know, sort of tips the scale a little bit further away from thorium making sense.
I think the gentleman there.
And last question, please.
Yeah. Saleh Marghani from Saudi Group, Ulayan Group. My question is mostly about the hydrogen, and a bit changing the subject from the AI. The question is, the green hydrogen today is under a lot of pressure from a demand side and supply side because of the cost. But nuclear provides a source of power that could make the hydrogen generation more available globally rather than only in countries where renewable resources are available, and that could potentially drive the hydrogen prices in terms of as the volumes of generation will increase. And also looking at basically it's cleaner compared, they do not call it green, they call it another shade of color. But so my question is, has that been in discussion in particular with the IEA?
Yes, it's been in discussion. Of course, we are looking into that, and what you said is right. Sometimes it's a bit ironic that people want to produce hydrogen through fossil, you know, fuel means of energy. So nuclear is available. There are plants. There's no actual at the moment production, but it's pink, by the way, in terms of the colors. That I don't know. I'm not responsible for that. But I know, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's in the catalog that they have. Yes, absolutely, what you said is correct. But at the moment, there is no production.
So I'm glad we got a question on the other SMR, finally, in this panel, the steam methane reformation, how they make the gray hydrogen. But I would just say, you know, on the balance, I'm a little bit negative on sort of the hydrogen economy. It's hard to store, it's hard to transport. So if you've got a beautiful reactor creating zero carbon electricity, just use that directly, and then the people talk about, well, you can store it as ammonia, and ammonia is a much better way to store hydrogen and transport it. But there's just you start getting into a lot of steps, and then the problem is also just that, you know, the steam methane reformation, you know, is always going to be cheaper than sort of the other routes to getting it, which is not, it's just not a great fact. It's sort of why I'm sort of mildly negative on sort of the hydrogen economy. We always need some hydrogen inputs for industry. A lot of that actually goes into fossil fuel production, but, you know, on the balance, like I don't know that we're going to see a whole bunch of, you know, reactors just creating hydrogen to kind of go into the hydrogen economy. That's just my view.
Yeah, Rachel, I would be highly surprised as well. I think just the conversation around demand and trying to find enough electricity and to meet demand, that you would use something like nuclear that is expensive to make hydrogen seems unlikely and also maybe quite inefficient. We did a story, looked in quite a lot of detail at using hydrogen to burn hydrogen in an electricity plant, and it's like you lose almost three quarters of the efficiency by doing that. So I think it's difficult to see that, but yeah, you never know, I suppose. Maybe if there's a mushrooming boom of, I don't want to say boom and nuclear in the same sentence though, of projects.
Or mushroom.
Thanks, Rachel. Unfortunately, we are out of time here, but the conversation on nuclear continues. If you would like to join DG Grossi this afternoon, he will be on a panel on tripling nuclear capacity. So if you are free at 3 o'clock at Aspen 4 in Kerr Park Village, you're welcome to join us there. But thank you for joining us, for taking the time. It's Davos, it's a busy week, but we know we're all keen to have this conversation on nuclear, AI, and data centers, so we're glad you could join us. And finally, please join me in thanking the panelists for joining us today.